Chapter 5, Elgin, Illinois, 1979 to 1981. This is a good example of how nuts I was. My friend Barbara had said the newspaper might pay for a few usable photographs. On the basis of that big might, I packed it all in and left a perfectly good job for one that promised a lot of struggle. You may think otherwise, that I was a courageous soul, grabbing at my dream regardless of the risks. No, no, no. I didn't have a dream, or even a desire to be a successful photographer. If I had, I would have stayed at Ohio U and slugged it out until I got a degree, then would have pursued a career in photography. In reality, I was craving a little chaos. Another indication of how squirrely I was that I didn't discuss my plans with anyone. I must have known that if I had, someone with a head on his shoulders and feet on the ground would have tried to talk me out of it. Later, in a conversation with my oldest brother Robert, I said that if I had discussed this plan with someone wiser, like him, he would have quietly pointed out all the good reasons for staying put and the bad reasons for moving on. Then he said, "No, you're more like Richard, my youngest brother. You would have asked for the advice, and then you would have ignored it." I think he was right. I didn't discuss this next move with any of my friends, either. I didn't want them to try and talk me out of it, and I didn't want them to walk away shaking their heads at my inexplicable stubbornness. I hugged a few people, shook a lot of hands, jumped into my car, and headed east. The drive to Elk Grove was uneventful. I arrived safe and sound at Barbara's house. She was divorced and had custody of her two children. The older child, John, was 10. Her daughter, Julie, was 7. I stayed with them until I got my feet on the ground. It didn't take long. After settling in for a day or two, I met my new bosses at the paper, presented my portfolio, and hoped they would think I could shoot a picture worthy of being published. They were satisfied that I knew which way to point a camera. The deal was that they would call me within minutes, hours, or days of a photo assignment. I was expected to take all assignments. The resulting photos, if they were published, would pay $10 each. I was also free to shoot whatever human interest photos I wanted. They would pay $10 for those, too, if published. I met the other freelancer, Herb, who was going to show me the ropes. He was a nice guy who did not seem threatened by me. But then, I am not a threatening person. Before I took any assignments, I had to find a regular job with decent pay and a place to live. I found both in Elgin, Illinois, 30 miles away. I had some money saved from Kansas City. I moved into a one-bedroom apartment on the second floor of a quad. I turned the bedroom into a dark room and the living room into a bedroom, family room, great room. I quickly found a job as a bartender. I had never attended a bar before, but like I've said regarding many prospective jobs, how tough could it be? The ad consisted of two words, bartender wanted, and a phone number. I called to get the address, cleaned up a bit, and headed over to the Walnut Inn. My confidence in getting hired soared as soon as I walked in the front door. I could see this was a working-class shot in a beer joint. From a mixologist standpoint, a monkey could do this job. During the interview with Tom, the owner, I told him that although I had no bartending experience, I was a people person, knew lots of jokes, and felt I would catch on quickly. With that statement and my outgoing personality shining through, I was hired and told to report to work the next evening. If I had known how much fun this job was going to be, I would have been more nervous about not getting the job. The clientele at the Walnut Inn were all over the map, ranging in age from 21 to 80. I never knew what kind of people I would run into in a job, whether fellow employees or customers. In this case, my employer and my co-workers were nothing out of the ordinary. But with the customers, I hit the jackpot. Their ranks consisted of middle and lower class folks from the neighborhood. Construction workers, truck drivers, old hippies, drug sellers, drug takers, obvious alcoholics, mean drunks, happy drunks, quiet drunks, and of course, loud drunks. We had our Cliff Clavin and Norm Peterson, and just like Cheers, the Clavin avatar, Kevin, was the goofy know-it-all whose information was barely based on fact. while the Peterson character, nicknamed Pinky because of his red hair, was the one everyone was really happy to see when he walked into the joint. Somewhere in the mix were customers who just happened to be driving by for their first or second time and came in for a beer. Last but not least were the day pass patients from the Illinois Mental Health Center just down the street. It was not an easy task identifying the registered nuts from the rest of the nuts. Most of the regulars knew them and never made a big deal out of it. Tom, the owner, reminded me of a parish priest. He walked with a pretty noticeable limp, but I never asked him about it. He was 50 years old. I had very little to do with Tom. Most of my contact was with Dave, the manager. Dave was a somewhat harried boss, occasionally exasperated with all the bullshit that comes from dealing with employees, drunks, and bar management. There were three or four other bartenders. Only one stood out, Shelley. She was short, a little overweight, and brunette. I think she had the hots for me. I am a legend in my own mind. One of the reasons I never pursued her was that she looked too much like my mother. I was quickly embraced by the regulars as someone who poured a decent shot, mixed a good drink, told a good joke, and possessed the prerequisite of any bartender, great listening skills. Pleasantly surprised is how I would describe my experience with the first woman I picked up, or who picked me up, from the Walnut Inn. As a matter of course, I was a very affable, sometimes funny, and usually engaging person when I wanted to be. This part of my personality really blossomed when I was behind the bar. One night, as the evening was drawing to a close, I noticed that one of the young women I had been supplying with free drinks all night was still hanging around. At some point, she asked me when my shift ended. Sometimes in my life, I have been naively blind to the interests of and attentions from women. At other times, it has been very clear, and I just agreed to the divorce. In this case, her signals were more than obvious. We agreed that she should wait for me, and then we would head over to her place for a nightcap. It dawned on me right before we arrived at her place that this bartending job was really perfect for picking up women. I could buy them drinks at no cost to me, talk to them at will, and within a couple of hours be endearing enough to achieve take-home status. Back then, we didn't have computer-equipped cash registers, calibrated pours on the bottles of whiskey, or anything that would have resulted in strict accountability. Thus, I was pretty free to pour gratis drinks to the deserving. And it wasn't just the women who were sometimes deserving. I like to keep the peacemakers happy. This was a fairly rowdy joint. It wasn't uncommon for a fight to break out at least once a week, and more frequently once a month, when the moon was full. For the most part, cooler heads prevailed and usually broke up the fights. These were the guys I took care of. Although I jump over the bar to break up a fight, I always timed it so I got there a split second after one of the patrons had already done my job. I'm not a big guy. For me, breaking up a fight could be as dangerous as being in one. I knew that I could get a fat lip breaking up a fight as easily as I could being in one. The fights I witnessed and eventually broke up were pretty ugly affairs. Broken noses, teeth fragments on the floor, blood on the edge of a bar, boots smashed in the face, faces shoved down on the bar. I rarely saw two people standing toe-to-toe, slinging threats and shoving each other. I think that only happens in grade school and in the movies. Most of the fights I witnessed started very quickly and ended quickly, and were very violent beginning to end. Full moon nights were the worst. It wasn't that more fights took place then, but that the crowd acted more rowdy and more bizarrely on those nights. If I arrived at the bar at 6 in the evening and knew that there was a full moon, I mentally prepared myself for a long night. The other nice thing about bartending in this place was that I drank for free. I started drinking 2 hours before closing time. By the time we cleaned up and closed the joint, I had a pretty nice buzz on. One other thing I picked up was a great recipe for egg rolls. On Friday nights, Shelley and Tom's wife would whip up a couple of hundred of these taste treats and sell them for 25 cents each. The recipe was simple. They mixed hot Jimmy Dean sausage, browned, with a mixture of chow mein noodles, wrapped it in an egg roll wrap, and deep-fried it. This delicacy was accompanied by a small bowl of sweet and sour sauce. I still make them. They are absolutely delicious. This job covered a lot of ground. other than being by far the best place to meet women, I made enough money to pay the rent. Per my expectations, though, I did not receive a single tip. I think I'm safe in saying that most denizens of working-class bars don't tip. Certainly not in this venue. Summer rolled around, and word went out that the Walnut Inn was sponsoring a softball team. I figured, why not? I was a lousy infielder, so I was positioned in deep right field. I could, however, always get on base. It was not that tough to hit a slow-pitch softball, and since I didn't have the strength to hit a home run, or, with my recently repaired knees, circle the bases, I never tried. Thus, I had a pretty respectable batting average. Unfortunately, that was the only respectable thing about this experience. The manager, player, for our team, Kevin, was the same guy I mentioned earlier, the bar's Cliff Clavin. He was tall, skinny, goateed, and generally irritating. In short, a real jerk. He yelled a lot, never encouraged us, and spent most of his breath before, during, and after the games telling us what we did wrong and how stupid we were. He finished his tirades by asking, "Why bother training any of you idiots?" The other players were not much better than I was, but I do think that a better manager could have gotten a little something out of us. We never had uniforms, not even a Walnut Inn t-shirt or hat. According to manager Kevin, we would not get any uniforms until we won our first game. Halfway through the season, we hadn't won a single game, so I became intent on a perfect losing season. I'm proud to say we achieved my goal, 0-14. My reputation on the team was built largely by showing up with a different woman every other game. I worked at the Walnut Inn for a year, filling in my days with freelance photography for the weekly paper. If I balanced my photography expenses against the money I earned from my published pictures, I barely broke even. I was more successful with human interest shots than with assignment shots, because with the former, I felt like I was accomplishing something. But I still made very little money. My human interest shots consisted of seasonal subjects, kids in playgrounds, or anything else that caught my eye that I thought the editors might like. I had two assignments that fell into the most famous people I've ever met or seen category. William F. Buckley Jr. was speaking at a local high school about some incredibly important conservative issue. It was my assignment to get a few candid shots of him. Later, I shot Ralph Nader as well. For the Buckley engagement, a small platform in the cafeteria was set up at one end of the room. 40 rows of chairs were separated by an aisle down the middle. I arrived after the entire crowd had been seated, and Bill, I call him Bill now, was either answering some important question or making an intelligent point. I quietly opened the door to the gym and started walking toward the front. Unfortunately, my crepe-soled shoes produced an audible, echo-resounding squeak with each step. Buckley exhibited wild facial expressions even when he wasn't speaking. He was a photographer's dream. On this occasion, the combination of what he was saying, while he listened to the squeak, 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 squeak of my shoes, produced many of those classic looks. He raised his nose in the air. He sent his eyebrows up to follow. He pursed his lips. He looked like he had just picked up a whiff of something that was either rancid or sublime. After I finally got in a position, I stayed there for the rest of the night. Bill was animated, as usual, and I gave the paper a nice series of shots of him. When I photographed the consumer activist Ralph Nader, I wore different shoes. Around the time that one-hour photo processing technology was getting off the ground, I was still working for the newspaper as one of two freelance photographers, the one not making much money. The owner of the shop where I took my color film to be processed, Bob, was getting ready to install a one-hour photo machine and asked if I would be interested in working for him running it. On the basis of conversations we had whenever I dropped off film, he figured I had enough on the ball to run one of these new machines. Seemed like a great idea to me. I had been in town for 3 months, had two jobs, and had just been offered a third. Since I wasn't making any money as a photographer, and I could continue bartending, I thought, why not? I'm fairly proficient on a computer now, but back then my technical skills were limited, even though it stated the opposite in my ever-expanding resume. Fortunately, I had other qualities that made me a good choice for this new experience. I didn't need many hours, and that was good because this guy didn't have much business. What I knew about cameras and photography would serve the customers well when they had a question. Eventually, my skill level progressed enough to work unsupervised. Ha-ha. Unfortunately, just as business started to pick up, Bob's lease ran out and was not going to be renewed. At great cost to him, Bob was forced to relocate in a new strip mall on one of those streets that are not a shortcut to anywhere. Unless Bob was going to advertise the hell out of this new location, we were sunk. For a while in the new location, we were averaging around 7 rolls of film a week. Not good. I usually ran the store alone. Bob was probably out looking for another job. Of those 7 rolls a week, one or two were from a local freelance photographer, Lynn, a lovely, funny, petite woman in her late 20s. We got along very well. After a few weeks, and more than a few hours of telling each other our life stories, she conceded that although she was relatively happy with her live-in boyfriend, she thought she was ready for an affair with an individual who was not apt to fall in love with her or become emotionally attached. She went on to explain that she had never done anything like that before, but was intrigued by the daring, risky aspects of it. I thought that finally someone had recognized me for that which I often dreamed about but had yet to achieve, a shallow sex object. I told her so. For the next 2 years, we got together about once a month at my place for a couple of hours of fun. I kept my promise, and she kept hers. Life is not always that simple. Bob's one-hour photo venture went under in 3 months. When the final day drew near, the technician for our equipment asked me if I would be interested in an assistant manager's position closer to Chicago, in Oak Park. He had an account that needed someone with a little one-hour photo experience. The money was quite a bit more than my bartending job, and it was still within driving distance for Lynn. This was a full-service camera sales and photo processing store. The one-hour equipment had been set up a month earlier. It was so successful that the manager of the store could no longer keep up with the volume and the rest of her duties, hence my new job. The one-hour equipment was set up in an enclosed room with a glass wall that ran parallel to the service counter in the store. It was virtually soundproof. Customers could stand near the end of the enclosure and watch their print shooting out of the rear of the machine. Pretty darn exciting. Unfortunately, the manager, Stacy, one of the most unhappy, uptight, anal-retentive, possibly man-hating, or gym-hating, wenches I had ever met in my life, was my immediate supervisor. I had one assistant working with me. Her name was Debbie. She was so cute it was painful. She was 16 and petite. Stacy referred to her as Missy, much the same way Seinfeld sneered his greeting to Newman. In my many jobs over the years as a manager, I have always tried to make the work environment as pleasant as possible. My employees tended to like me, enjoyed my style, and laughed at my jokes. Supervisors with a different management outlook tended to hate me. Such was the case with Stacy. Although Debbie and I always got our work done professionally and on time, it seemed to drive Stacy nuts that Debbie and I got along so well. Stacy's work area, behind the counter, faced our sound-deadened, glassed-in area. Stacy would yell at us for laughing while we were working, even though she couldn't hear us, and for talking too much while we were working. She couldn't hear that either. I think merely seeing her smiling faces drove her nuts. I have that effect on people sometimes. Before Stacy could mount a successful campaign to have me fired, the same technician who got this job for me was offered a manager's position for a one-hour company back in Kansas City, Missouri. He asked me if I was interested in moving there as his assistant manager. I was. It took a few phone calls to settle on the salary and moving expenses. After my 2-week notice was up, it took a day or two to pack and go. Goodbye, Walnut Inn. Goodbye, newspaper. Goodbye, Debbie. And sadly, goodbye to my no-strings-attached girlfriend, Lynn. Debbie quit. I was happy. Stacy was no doubt happy to see me go, but was probably still miserable.